How do you think you met as far as the expectations of what you had originally written your grant for, the so-called disintegration of the caste system?
They hadn't heard about the disintegration of the caste system, except they worried about me disintegrating the caste system. What happened was the barber, I was so lucky. I got this barber. He was about 60 years old, had about half his teeth, but he was very garrulous, and he wanted to talk about everything and everybody. And the barber's wife. They're the midwives, and they're the hairdressers. And the barbers, of course, know what's going with the men. And the barbers are the people who carry all the wedding invitations and do the wedding negotiations and all kinds of things like that. So it was an absolute goldmine of information, this barber. And he would know about everything. I'd say, well, what about so-and-so? Well, he's doing this and that, and his daughters and his sons, and you know, everybody's information was right there. So, great. I thought, lovely, you know, I'll hire this man. Oh, he's crazy to be hired because I was going to pay them cash, you know, not kind. They did a lot of barter, but I didn't have anything else to barter, but plenty of money. So he was really eager to do this, and I signed him up right away. He's going to wash my dishes. Well, my dishes consisted of two metal plates. That was about it. And he was going to bring water and put it in my tank. And there was no running water, of course, but I had a sort of big container for water with a spigot on it. Well, the next day he came to me and he said, sorry, I've got to quit. I can't work for you. Why not? Because my Brahmin patrons would be polluted by you. If he washes my dishes, he would be polluted. Now, that had great implications because most of his best customers were Brahmins. And not only that, but he had a daughter to marry, another one. And she couldn't marry anybody because he would be polluted, and she would be. So everything depended on that. And the Brahmins were very upset with me because I was going to destroy their service system, invalidate the whole caste of barbers. And there were, it was a, the reason why it was a bigger village that had 1,100 people in it. No, it was about 850 then. One reason why it had 24 castes in it, because they were serving all the surrounding little villages around. And the barbers, though, a whole lot of barbers there, they were serving 10 other villages. So this would be terrible, you know, this is the Jugravain, you might say, that I was threatening by asking this man to wash my dishes. So then I began, you know, follow this out, and there was a very great, very hostile reaction by the Brahmins. And they thought, of course, that I would eat meat and throw bones around and you know, generally disrupt things and sit with the untouchables in the village and threaten. And then, of course, rumors. Oh, my goodness. So many rumors they had about me, the terrible things that I'd done. And I would hear this through my interpreter or through the barber. I kept the barber around anyway. I didn't make him wash the dishes, but he was, you know, he was a very welcome visitor to my house whenever I could get him in. He loved to come and hang around anyhow. So, but the rumors were terrific. Well, it just happened that in another village 10 miles away, another anthropologist had arrived. And this was a woman named Gittel Steed, Gittel Poznanski Steed, who had come from Columbia University. The Columbia University program in other cultures had been financed by the Office of Naval Research, and again part of the war morale business. And she had been intending to work in China, as had my professor Robert Redfield here. In fact, he was in China, and then the communists took over. He was in a village not far from Beijing, but he was thrown out by the communists, asked to leave. And so she, from Columbia, that project, which is also going to be in China, was terminated. But the Columbia people said, we got all this money, and the Office of Naval Research doesn't ask for it back, so how about we go to India instead? Well, so they'd gone to India on a moment's notice, and they'd been working in Gujarat for a year. But then they moved over. They worked on a Hindu village in Gujarat, in western India, and then they wanted to do a Muslim village, and they chose an Aligarh district. This is entirely I had no idea they were coming, but people said, well, there's another anthropologist here. So I heard, you know, and that was Gil Steen. And she came with a fairly large party of assistants. Now, where were we?
Well, one question is how you ended up navigating the matrix of all of these caste dynamics.
Well, I did all the usual anthropological things. That is, I tried to get acquainted with every family in the village. I did genealogies, get the names of everybody. Of course, I got a lot of false names and crazy information, the way Jeffrey Gore said I would. You know, people were afraid of me, of course. But they had rumors. They thought I was going to take all the children and put them in orphanages the way the missionaries had done during famines. They had these stories, you know, about the way these foreigners act. They'd never seen an American before. Most of them had never seen any European person before, as a matter of fact, in that village, because it was way out in the sticks. The place that was as far as possible from any regular lines of communication, so it would have all the more conservative features, and it certainly did. But they were worried, and my colleague, Gittel Steed over there, she was relatively naive. She didn't have any Indian language at all. But she was a psychologist. She'd done a lot of work with Margaret Mead. She was Margaret Mead, and Morris Carstairs was on her staff initially in Gujarat. He's a psychoanalyst doctor, a medical doctor who'd been come under Margaret Mead's aegis when he was posted in New York during the war. But anyhow, Carstairs, well, she as a where was I? Complicated story. The rumors, that was the rumor. She solved the rumor problem for me, because she had rumors, and they had developed a technique in Gujarat for collecting rumors about themselves. And so they would collect the rumors and read them back to the villagers every night when they had a new collection of rumors. And of course, the people who were nearby, their neighbors, and so on, knew these were false rumors in many cases. And they would be amused by these rumors. And that's what I did, and it worked wonderfully. And we had a lovely time. We had sort of evening parties reading rumors about ourselves, you know. And of course, the villagers were pretty good at making up rumors. I'd cut off the breast of a barber woman in order to get this house, and I was going to take over all the fields and start up a collective farm, or I was going to build a skyscraper. The only idea they had, you see, many of the people I had, was from these little peep shows, that little thing around the village, you know, and they had pictures of New York skyscrapers and things like that. And so they figured, yeah, I was going to build skyscrapers. That's how the Americans get these tremendous yields from their fields, by making one on top of the other. So they were going to, anyway, I was going to take all these crazy things I was going to do. Dangerous guy.
Now, right at that time, if I'm not mistaken, there was a rich cohort of people who were beginning to study South Asia at that time, around the time that you began also.
Yes, others came in, yes. Morris Carstairs, not Morris Carstairs, Morris Oppler from Cornell had set up a program in East UP, and then set up another one in West. But apparently he didn't get on very well with the Lucknow people. He had these two stations in Uttar Pradesh, and he offended them somehow, and they felt some rivalry, and ultimately made it very unpleasant for him. So he had to leave. but he had some students, and some of his students got into trouble. He assembled a team, they built a big bungalow in one of his villages, which then housed the field workers. I think that was a mistake. They weren't living the life of the people. They weren't doing participant observation, really. And they were much more focused. They went in and they were studying this or that particular topic, and they were relatively narrow people. I was in a small community trying to do everything. My idea was holistic research. Well, ultimately I did. So I tried various social psychological questionnaires and things like that that were focused as part of the whole thing. I mean, I asked people to describe each other. And so I was interested in the terms they used for the descriptions. And I generally asked open-ended questions. I used TATs and picture stories and so on. I didn't find those things very useful, though, really, because people were so full of stories anyway that I didn't really need to show them pictures to get them to talk. They're very talkative people. Very, very talkative. So that part was easy.
Mm-hmm. And then you said that you were studying with Robert Redfield. He became your graduate advisor.
Well, he did. He wasn't ever, no, actually. But he was, of course, cooking up big designs for India, and he wanted to study the whole civilization. He wanted to study civilizations. And he'd been an ambulance driver in World War I in France, and he was a pacifist, and he was just so sick of war. And he wanted to do anything with the new United Nations being formed that would promote mutual understanding among nations. That was his major motivation in starting this. And they got this big Ford Foundation grant. He, with Milton Singer, philosopher turned anthropologist here, they were just taking over. Milton hadn't come to the department while I was there in training. But Redfield was there just as I was coming back. But in fact, before I'd come back, he was writing me letters. And I had gone to some of his seminars. I'd never taken a course with him, actually. And he was not my advisor, but he was my guru in another sense. And I was very impressed with him. I liked him a lot. And I was a teaching assistant for him, I think, the year before I went. And I felt very, very happy with him as an intellectual inspirer. And he then began asking big questions, you know, about the civilization as a whole. And so he was interested he and Milton developed this idea of the great and little traditions, which I didn't think was a good idea at all, but nevertheless it was clear that I could answer a lot of questions about that. That is, the different, we had these Sanskrit level, you know, somehow or other. M. N. Srinivas, leading Indian sociologist, had been very cordial to me also. Srinivas had just taken over the professorship in Baroda, sociology department, University of Baroda. And when I came to India, and I called on him, and he was very, very welcoming and very eager to have other anthropologists working, you know, and to do this holistic. Well, then Srinivas and Singer got together. Singer was then working in India for most of the year, I think. So they got acquainted, and that brought me together with the whole question of, you know, and brought Singer into the great little issue. While I liked the idea of doing the whole, that holism idea was terribly important to me. Do the whole civilization, to see everything in the largest possible context. You know, start worldview, everything. Let's really get cosmology from the villager up. And whatever the social relations are that connect the higher and the lower levels and so on. Well, I could see lots of evidence for that going on in the village. Oh, so much going on. So I could supply Redfield with anything he wanted, you know, in the way of leads and information and suggestions. So we had a very cordial relationship.
It's interesting, that idea of studying a civilization instead of a village inside of a culture. You published a paper quite a bit later about ethno-sociology.
Oh, yes.
That seemed to speak to that.
Yes, that was certainly a Redfield idea. When I was working with him as an assistant, reading papers and things like that, he said, well, this is just routine social science. That was, you know, that you just take American social science and apply it, or, you know, use Weber or Marx or whatever you want, but to do it without asking their ideas was a big mistake. So the idea of working with indigenous logics, indigenous categories, was fundamental. And I kept that in the back of my mind. I did a lot of statistical research at first that was pure American social science, I think, at the beginning. Lots of observations. I have thousands of little slips of particular observations of who's talking to who. I tried to identify everybody in the village. And then I would just wander around the village every day, the usual anthropological thing, try to cover the whole picture, you see. Meet everybody. No, don't just get one informant. Everybody's your informant. But I wrote down everything that I saw all in all. Very, very picky business. And I added them all up, see. And I could see, one of the amazing things I saw right away was that people of different castes were friends. My God. You know, according to the literature, they never talked to each other. They never ate. They never did anything together. That wasn't the case at all. There were 1,000 people, and they were all doing, they were all related to each other in special ways. But I had to then see that it wasn't just A and B talking, but it was A talking first and B talking second, or A's sitting down and B standing up, and, you know, all the little niceties of social relations. I had to learn all of that, all this thousands of little slips and their uses. So, God, the statistical approach, I had to learn their ways of counting things. So I'd ask, what did you see today? You know, and get their ideas. I did a lot of that kind of stuff, mostly just listening. Not asking a whole lot of questions. I did try to do everything normal, you know, you would do in the way of getting a census and land records and all that kind of thing.
Now you went back for an extended period of research.
Yes.
A few years later.
A few years later, right.
Yeah, and what was what brought you back, and was it in the...
Well, it was the Green Revolution that brought me back. It was 19 years after my first day. I stayed in the village first more than a year. When I came back, I was quite focused, and I had by then worked up all the basic facts about the village, you know, and all the people, everybody was on a slip, and I had boxes and boxes of detailed information about the physical situation and everything else, really. But then I could see the tremendous changes going on. They'd gotten electricity. I actually helped bring the electricity in myself. I'm almost sorry for it, but I like the old peasant culture an awful lot. You know, it was very, very interesting and so different. But I brought in the electricity that helped light the houses. They were getting some for wells, for pumps on, electric pumps on wells. But there was so much going on. They were having the first national election the time I was there. This was then another election candidate come along at this point. So I was seeing the second complete election at the village level. There was politics about this. And new laws had come in, and the first time I was there, they were doing land reform. So they were giving bonds to the farmers who had to pay 10 times their rent in order to become owners. That is, almost all the farmers were tenants under the old tenancy system. The new tenancy system made them owners, and they were paying directly to the government. They wiped out the landlord class that was in the world. Well, the landlord was being abolished. That was about it. Landlordism was being abolished. So I'd known a lot of the landlords, and so it was a wonderfully tumultuous time for things happening. And that, in that year also, my house was robbed. And that that turned out to be very fascinating because the village had to go into action to try to solve my my crime. And of course, they were full of hypotheses as to who done it. And that was very interesting because I had planned to do an economic survey in the fields at the time, but everywhere I went in the fields, people would say, stereotype, who did it? But I got, you know, wonderful field notes, you might say, on crime. And then I went, after several months, the villagers said, well, this is terrible. This is a terrible reputation for our village that we robbed a guest. And you just got to go to the police. We haven't solved the problem. So I went to the police. And they said, don't go to the police. I mean, initially, they said, don't go to the police. They'll just take a lot of bribes and put the wrong person in jail. And so I went to the police, and they came in. They said, well, we need your help. It was 6 miles from the police station, and we've got to come in at night, so you bring your Jeep, and you carry us into the village. Well, that didn't sound like the role I wanted, you know, as an anthropologist, turned out to be a policeman. I said, well, okay, but you mustn't actually make me take the car. I'll stop the car a mile from the village. And then they said, well, we'll give you a disguise. You can wear a police coat and a cap and carry a big stick. And so on. And so I did that. And then I hung in, we went there at 2 a.m. or something like that, and tried to round up the usual suspects. But I just stood in the shadows, you see. I stayed out, sort of observed this. They got one scallywag who was a sort of villain joker and a dope seller. And one of my best informants, he was so full of wonderful folklore, but he was one of the guys they put the finger on, and they tortured him. And he confessed, in a sense, that is, he named the son of the landlord as the thief. Which, of course, then the police went to the landlord and got a great big bribe. And I learned about this from the village kids, because the kids are all over everything. And most of the people were living outdoors in these courtyards that had no roofs. Their houses really were just had sort of closets for storing grain or something, or getting out of the rain. But otherwise, they were audible. And the kids were going over the walls all the time, listening to the gossip. And they'd seen the landlord pay the bribe, and they'd seen where the stolen goods were stowed in the landlord's grandmother's chest. And anyway, they gave me the full information. So then I actually had photographs of all of this, these procedures, I mean, many parts of them. And then I could go to the police and say, you took a bribe and you put the wrong man in jail. And I had given them a reward. I had offered a reward for the solution thing just to get things going. I didn't have much longer to stay. And I then asked them to return the reward. So I had the police then, and then I got information from the police about how they operated. But I began to feel a bit worried because they had guns and I didn't. So I was glad to be leaving, but I thought I'd have trouble because I put the wrong man in jail. Well, actually, most people were glad to have the wrong man in jail because they didn't think he was the wrong man. He was waiting. He needed to jail. Well, he ultimately died in jail, and he was not a member of an important kin group in the village. So when I went back 19 years later, I thought, well, that's going to be some trouble for me there. I don't know. Nobody thought about it at all. In fact, I learned some of his poetic orations, which were very comical, the things that I'd learned from him. I'd written them all down phonetically so I could pull out my notes and read these things, you know. The villagers thought they were hilarious. But this dead man, this dead thief's orations were delightful. Everybody thought that was just fun. When I went back, I then lived in the head man's house in the second. They were really cordial to me, entirely different from the first time. And I was immediately brought into the head man's house. I was installed in his living room as my quarters for 6 months. And everybody wanted to come and see me and tell me all about them and all the things that had happened in the 19 years past. So it was a lovely time. Mm-hmm. Very, very fortunate.
I have two more. This has been so delightful. I have two more questions. One is just a question about your cohort, who your most important collaborators and colleagues were as you grew up in Indianist anthropology.
Well, there were a lot of them. A great many of them were ones I created, in the sense that is students. We had some wonderful, wonderful students, and I was blessed with students. At first, I was doing this routine stuff, doing my statistics and so on, and I had good people who I was wasting the time of, I think, by employing them, you know, as assistants. But as time went on, I learned a lot more, and my angles changed greatly. I went to the Behavioral Sciences Center for a year at Stanford, and that changed my mind about a lot of things. I was able to learn a lot of math that I hadn't learned in high school. And by then, there was a lot of stuff that wasn't just ordinary statistics, but it was formal relations. So I was very impressed. I had a man in sociology here who later went to Harvard, Harrison White, maybe.
Sure.
And, but he inspired me. He said, look here, you can do graph theory and formal relations, which permits you to do just exactly what you wanted to do with caste. And it was really a godsend. It was entirely different. So I learned scaling and other non-parametric stuff and graphing. And I like to draw pictures, and I like that. And I began doing three-dimensional graphing, and the three dimensions went to town with, and that's what I'm working on now. But my other people in the university who inspired me were not a whole lot. I mean, David Schneider did, but his American Kinship stuff I was attracted to because of its beautiful simplicity. Just a 2x2 square diagram was the essence of the whole thing. And I thought, well, that would be very interesting if I could do something as revealing as that, to sort of model Indian civilization in a little 2x2 diagram. But I couldn't do it, and it was clear that it didn't work. Well, then I had a couple of students then, of course, Schneider was affected by Levi Strauss. And he wasn't the only one. Levi Strauss was very much in fashion. Levi Strauss came here, and but what I read of Levi Strauss didn't work. The Indian things were not 2x2. They were not dichotomous. You couldn't talk about oppositions. You could talk about differences, about comparisons. You could do, but you couldn't. They didn't have any parametrics to them at all. That's like the Indian things, or maybe most things in the world don't. But the Indian ones certainly did. In fact, they're philosophically against it. So then my colleagues here in Indology were very important. Hansard Biden, for instance, he was an expert in not only Mahabharata, Sanskrit in general. He read it like a native. But he also was expert on Sankhya. And Sankhya is the kind of, it's the most elemental, the most pervasive, still the most, the best known, and the most, I would say, structuring of all, comprehensive in the way that it structures all of Indian life. It deals with the five elements, earth, air, fire, water, ether. And I found, and I'm finding right now, that all of these are really very, very important. And you don't think, well, that's not social science, or theory of framework. But it is, because they build a whole lot of social categories on it. They build qualities of the mind, kinds of human action, kinds of human sensation, everything in politics, food, religion, everything is built on this five thing. Well, now it isn't really five dimensions, but there's three dimensions plus space, plus place. Location like Earth or something, or the location of anything, the container of anything. Anyway, I have not been working on interpreting these things in the there are five or six different Indian schemes that are all parallel. None of the Indologists have seen that they're all parallel, and I'm finding them in peasants, so and in everyday life. So this is a big project and very exciting for me. So I was working with A.K. Ramanujan, and then later Van Buiten unfortunately died. But he took me into Sankhya, to Ayurveda, which is Indian medicine, And then I worked with Francis Zimmermann, who in Paris, who was a student of Dumont, and he was concentrating on Ayurveda. And so those are the principal people, the Indologists, Ramanujan the poet, dear friend. And we all learned so much from Ramanujan. It was just amazing. He was a poet and a linguist, and very interested in social science, and a folklorist. And he had done all this kind of South Indian folklore, so he was very good in pointing out where, you know, things were different in South India and all that. Very imaginative guy, so I just went around to all kinds of meetings with him, and he kept inviting me to India, and so we had a lovely, lovely time. Those guys, and then my students, and I had some wonderful students, and I had about, well, I directed about 30 or 40 PhDs, and most of them in India, and a very large part of them my kind of people, that is that they wanted to do things in indigenous conceptual systems, and they went right for those issues that they could structure around local concepts and things, local logics, and swept away the nonsense. Our big bugaboo was Louis Dumont himself, because he was trained in anthropology, sort of. He actually didn't have a PhD in anthropology, but he'd hung around Marcel Mauss, the sociologist, and got himself a job in anthropology. He had never done anthropological field work in the usual sense. He'd done some interviewing out of context of members of a South Indian tribe. He never studied the caste system. And then he wrote a book on caste. This was crazy. But he tried to do a community study in Uttar Pradesh, but he fell ill, and he left after a couple of months. He never did a community study. He'd only studied uprooted tribal informants, and he'd only done their kinship. He knew nothing about rank. The first article I ever wrote, I published by accident, because it was a field report that I'd written for my professor, again, actually, got hold of it. I sent it to Lloyd Warner, and he gave it to Fred Agin, and Fred Agin said, well, we're starting up a new magazine about economic development, so why don't we publish this? He didn't ask me, just published it. And in the first number, the first issue, first volume of Economic Development Cultural Change, this journal that was coming out of here, Bert Hoselt, bless his soul, was the editor. Nobody asked me. They published it, and it had the real name of the village in it. I was trying to do it under a pseudonym. So they blew my cover in my very first publication. And this was bad, because I wanted to publish all kinds of things that needed a cover about the village, you know, crime and whatever else. Anyhow, it got me started. but in that article, especially in the second one, which was published with my approval later, under a pseudonym, I focused it all on hierarchy, on the term, which was used in American sociology just to mean up and down relations, you know, just asymmetrical relations between people. But Dumas used the word. I had met him coming out of the field. I met him while he was writing up his South Indian kinship stuff at Oxford. I'd stopped by to see him. I was fascinated by his what he picked up from Levi-Strauss, I guess, which was the idea that marriage is not about extending the lineage. It's about getting brothers-in-law, you know, about affinal relations. And that was fascinating. And I loved the article. The first, I wanted two articles that he published. In fact, one article. And I had gone to Oxford to see him because I admired this article. It was so fresh and interesting. It raised all kinds of questions. I'd done a lot of kinship in the field and so on. We had fascinating conversation. But this idea of hierarchy, I mentioned it, I think, I don't know, 20 times in that first article of mine. And he said, well, that's so surprising, you know. He didn't understand about hierarchy. He doesn't even mention hierarchy in any of his, just in his kinship, where he doesn't even see senior and junior as an issue. I mean, there's just no, it's all an interchange. It's all marriage, and there's no descent to speak of. I mean, they put in the descent lines, but he doesn't understand high and low relations, which to me were the most utterly striking and for an American and egalitarian, you know, that you would find everything, every relationship is structured high and low somehow. Everything you say and the way you say it and so on. And then he amazed me by making this the topic of his book. He had no field work on it. And most of the people he quoted, there were old reports. He didn't have any students working in the field. He didn't have detailed. He picked up some stuff from Adrian Nair. Well, Adrian did very well, but he did not systematize it, and he did not theorize the high-low stuff. So it was the only approximation, and basically he just got it wrong, terribly wrong. But he claimed it was all, and then he went back, he insisted it was all French sociology. He was going in at a time of De Gaulle, I guess, was in power then. He told me that he had to get a job in Paris. He really didn't know anything about North India, that he had to get a job there, and he had, as a prisoner of war, he learned Sanskrit. Well, he was captured in Maginot, so he had several years studying in prisoner camp, Sanskrit. So he knew some Sanskrit, but he didn't know much, and he didn't see any, hadn't done any Sanskrit in context. So he didn't know any Ayurveda, he didn't know any Sankhya, he didn't know any the real basics. But he was writing all in terms of Brahmins. He spent this 3 months in a Brahmin village, in a Brahmin household, really, where he was sick for 3 months. And that was, he got the Brahmin view, and he published it, and then everybody, it was pure French sociology. The hierarchy that he was talking about was the French Catholic Church. And he just, he uses the word, and he says, hierarchy is all religious. Well, it didn't look religious at all where I was. It was, you know, ownership, it was power, it was people getting beaten up, it was, high and low class, you know, you'd find extreme stratification, which people didn't understand what hierarchy, oh, yes, or you could say there was something to do with purity and pollution, that's true, but that wasn't a rationale, it wasn't anything, you know, it wasn't, anyway, that was the big problem, but the world wanted to study that because it was so European, and everybody went crazy, well, not everybody, but a lot of people did, and that was all, then that really was a big, big problem. So my students all had to say, it is not the way Dumas says, and then they were attacking Dumont and so on, you know, so we had a lot of wasted time on the polemics. But anyhow, the students were great, and I just had one after the other, and particularly it was wonderful because they would each go and they did really proper field work. They'd all go and they'd stay a year or two and they'd live in community and they'd do the whole community and pick up all kinds of stuff. So I was very pleased with a lot of the results. And many of them were women, and they began working. This is a time when a lot of women were coming into anthropology for the first time, and they were doing things that had never been done before talking about kinship in India and families. So I had several wonderful sources of information. These people kept, then the Social Science Research Council in New York, I went back to, and we had a person there named David Zanton, who was actually done a PhD on the Philippines here with Fred Egan. And he'd become the sort of person who was supposed to deal with most of Asia, I think, at the time at the Social Science Research Council. And he came here and asked us, what do we do? And what should we do with India? And Ron Inden and Ralph Nicholas were my students. Oh, well, and Ron was actually a student in history. Nicholas was my student in anthropology, my second student, I guess, here. They had gotten to work on Bengali kinship, and they were using indigenous ways of talking about kinship. And their book was wonderful, as far as I was concerned. It was really exciting. And they were working right alongside me. They were working with Schneider, but they were having a fight with Schneider pretty soon because Schneider wanted it all to look like Israeli kinship or something. It didn't. So, and Schneider had great difficulty with because he loved to torture people. And he would, I was very attracted to him and to his ideas. I found him a fascinating guy. But he started a cabal against me, and so I had three terrible years as chairman while he was trying to besmirch my reputation in every conceivable way, and he had a clique of students that were supposed to denounce me in various ways. It was awful. But nevertheless, I had Nicholas and Inden's Bengali book to work with, and that was a great asset. So they and the women students, and then the Social Science Research Council picked up all of this whole business of indigenous conceptual systems that they were working with. And by then, I really had something going. And they gave me six years support from Social Science Research Council so I could run a seminar here with bringing in guests. Instead of doing it all in one big blast, we decided that we had to train people, because the anthropologists had to learn a lot of Indology. And the Indologists we worked with had to learn some anthropology. And we needed people to go back and forth between the social sciences and the humanities. And it was an ideal situation because we had a growing program here in South Asia. And it was a very happy time. So we had visitors coming in and a lot of attendance, and they were all writing interesting things. Val Daniel and these other people, Columbia and Sherry Ortner. They were just a great lot of people. And that, of course, is over now. But it was a great boost. That's how I was able to get a whole bunch of dissertations done. And each time a new dissertation would get done, that would come back into the seminar, and the next group of students would then.
On the way over, Andreas was telling us that Indian studies is phenomenally strong here in Chicago, so it has been,
because right now we have very little. It's all totally different, and I think it probably should be. But they certainly lost the sense of a whole, as far as I can see. And nobody's talking about civilization, so that's what I have to do.